Chapter 10. The Ford was standing finished in the workshop, and no new work had come in. We should have to get busy with something. Custer and I had gone to an auction to buy a taxi that was being sold. Taxis could always be sold again. The place was a muse in the north of the city. Besides the taxi, there was a lot of other stuff to be sold, some of which was standing in the yard. Beds, rickety tables, a gilded cage with a parrot that said, "Hello, dearie," a grandfather clock, some books, cupboards, an old dress suit, kitchen chairs, cooking utensils, all the pitiful equipment of a crumbling, broken life. We arrived too early. The auctioneer was not there yet. I was rooting about among the things for sale when I came on some old books. Cheap, well-thumbed copies of the Greek and Latin classics, with numerous manuscript notes in the margins. In the discolored, battered pages were to be read no more the verses of Horace, the songs of Anacreon, only the cry of distress and despair of a life that was lost. To their owner, whoever he was, these books had been a haven of refuge. He had kept them to the last, and if he sent them here, it meant his life was finished. Custer looked over my shoulder. "Pathetic, eh?" I nodded. "These too, Otto," said I, pointing to the other things. "Kitchen chairs and wardrobes aren't sent here for fun." We went to the car, which was standing in a corner of the yard. The paint was chipped and worn in places, but the car was clean, even under the mudguards. A stocky little man with big dangling hands was standing nearby. He looked at us dully. "Have you looked over the machine?" I asked Custer. "Yesterday," said he. "It's a bit worn, but well looked after." I nodded. "Seems so," said I. "It has been washed down only this morning, Otto. The auctioneer guys didn't do it, that's certain." Custer shook his head and looked at the stocky figure. "That'll be the owner. He was here yesterday. I saw him polishing the car." "Damn it all," said I. "The man looks like a dog that has been run over." A young man came across the yard towards the car. He was wearing a coat with a belt and had a disagreeably smart appearance. "This'll be the bus, I suppose," said he, half to us and half to the other man, tapping the bonnet with his cane. I saw the other man wince. That's nothing," said the belted one loftily. "The paint's not worth a brass tack. Venerable old crock. Ought to be in a museum, what?" He laughed loudly at his joke and looked to us for approval. We were not laughing. He turned to the owner. "What do you want for grandfather?" The man swallowed hard but said nothing. "Its price is scrap iron?" bleated the young man in high fettle. He turned to us again. "Are you gentlemen interested?" He lowered his voice. "Let's fix it between us. Buy it for nothing, turn it in again, and split the profits. No point in giving them money. My name, by the way, is Tease. Guido Tease, of the Augeca." He twirled his bamboo cane and winked at us knowingly. There are no secrets to this worm, thought I angrily. The silent figure by the car was troubling me. "You know," said I aloud, "you oughtn't to be called Tease." "No," said he, flattered. He was evidently used to being complimented on his sharpness. "Yes," I went on. "Twerp, you ought to be called. Guido Twerp." He started back. "Of course," he remarked at last. 2-1. "Of course." "If that's your trouble," said I, "I'll take you on alone whenever you like." "Thanks," replied Guido frostily. "Thanks very much," and retired. The stocky man with the troubled face just stood there, staring at the car, as if nothing signified anymore. "Let's not buy it, Otto," said I. "If we don't, then your poodle Guido will," replied Custer. "We can't do anything to help the fellow." "True enough," said I, "but a lot hangs on it." "Yes, But what doesn't a lot hang on these days, Bob? You can be sure of this. It's a damn good thing for the owner we are here. He'll get a bit more for it. But I promise, if the poodle doesn't bid, I won't either. The auctioneer arrived. He was in a hurry. He had a lot to do, apparently. For him, there were auctions by the dozen every day. With comprehensive gestures, he started selling the pitiful junk. He had the cast-iron humor and matter-of-factness of one who deals daily in misery, without ever himself being touched by it. The things went for a few pence. Dealers bought most of it. They would lift a finger indolently whenever the auctioneer looked in their direction, or just shake their heads. But from time to time, another pair of eyes followed the auctioneer's glance. Careworn eyes of a woman. Eyes that watched the dealer's finger as if it had been the finger of God. Full of hope and fear. Three people bid for the taxi. First, Guido, 300 marks. A shameful underbid. The stocky man took a step forward. His lips moved, but without sound. For one moment, he looked as if he intended to join in the bidding. But the hand sank. He stepped back. The next bid was 400 marks. Guido went to 450. Then a pause. The auctioneer called for other bids. No offers. Going for the first time. Going for the second time. The man by the taxi was standing with wide eyes and bowed head, waiting for the blow. 1,000, said Custer. I looked at him. It's worth 3, he muttered. I'm not going to see the chap slaughtered. Guido was signaling frantically. He had forgotten the insult, now it came to business. 1,100, he bleated, winking at us with both eyes at once. If he had another one behind, he would have winked that as well. 1,500, said Custer.
1,510, announced Guido perspiringly.
1,800, said Custer. Guido touched his forehead and abandoned the struggle. The auctioneer was hopping with excitement. Suddenly I thought of Pat. 1,850, said I without quite meaning to do so. Custer turned his head in surprise. I'll make up the 50, said I hastily. It's in aid of something. An investment. He nodded. The auctioneer knocked the car down to us. Custer paid immediately.
What did I tell you? Said Guido, coming over as if nothing had happened. We could have had it for 1,000 marks. We bluffed the third chap out pretty soon.
Hello, dearie, shrieked a brazen voice behind him, the parrot in the gilded cage.
Twerp, I added.
Guido shrugged his shoulders and vanished.
I went across to the owner of the car. A pale-faced woman was now beside him.
Sorry, said I.
It's all right, he replied. We would sooner not have done it, said I, but you would only have got less.
He nodded, twisting his hands.
She's a good car, he burst out suddenly, tumbling over himself. She's a good car, well worth the money. Really, she is. You haven't paid too much.
It isn't the car so much. Not at all. It's...
I know, said I.
And we don't get any of the money, said the woman. It all goes.
We'll soon come up again, mother, said the man. We'll come up again. The woman did not answer.
She grinds a bit, changing from first to second, said the man. But it's not a defect. She did that when she was new.
He might have been talking of a child.
It's 3 years we've had her now, and she has never given the least trouble. You see, I was ill, and then a bloke let me down, a friend.
A villain, said the woman with a grim face.
Now, mother, said the man and looked at her. I'll come up again soon, mother. Now won't I? The woman did not answer. The man was wet with sweat.
Give me your address, said Custer.
We may want to drive her sometime. You never know. The man wrote eagerly with his heavy, honest hands. I looked at Custer. We both knew it would need a miracle before we could offer anything, and there are no miracles these days. He would go under, most likely. The man talked and talked like a man in high fever. The sale was over, and we were now alone in the yard. He gave us some tips about starting it in winter. Again, he kept going to the car. At last he was silent. Now come, Albert, said the woman. We shook hands with him, and they went. We waited until they were out of sight, and then started the car. As we passed down the street, we saw a little old woman with a parrot cage in her arms, warding off a group of children. Custer pulled up. Like a lift? He asked her.
In these days? I've no money to go gadding about in taxis.
You don't need any, said Otto. Today's my birthday, and I am driving for fun. She held on to her cage suspiciously.
But it will cost something afterwards?
He reassured her, and at last she got in. What did you buy the parrot for, Mother? Said I as she was getting out.
For the nights, said she. Do you think the food is very expensive?
No, said I. But why for nights?
He can talk, you see,
she replied, looking at me with clear, aged eyes.
Now there will always be someone there who will talk.
Ach so, said I. The baker came during the afternoon to collect his Ford. He looked gray and sour. I was alone in the yard. Do you like the color? I asked. So-so, said he, and looked at it dubiously. The upholstery looks well. Certainly. He still hung around, apparently unable to make up his mind to go. I expected him to try to screw something out of us, a jack, an ashtray, or some such. But it proved otherwise. He shuffled about for some time, examining this thing and that thing. Then he looked at me with his bloodshot eyes and said, And just think, only a few weeks ago she was sitting there, alive and happy. I was surprised to find him suddenly so sentimental, and guessed that the flashy little Jane he had with him last time was already beginning to get on his nerves. She was a good wife, he went on. A jewel, I might say. She never wanted a thing. 10 years she wore the same coat. Blouses and so on she made all herself. And the housework, no maid. Aha, thought I. The new one doesn't. That's obvious. He told me how economical his wife had been. It was extraordinary how deeply the memory of money saved affected this Skittles addict. She did not even let herself be photographed, cost too much. He had only one picture of the wedding group, and a few snaps. That gave me an idea. You ought to get somebody to do a real slap-up portrait of her, said I. Then you'd have something for always. Photographs fade in time. There's a painter up here who does that sort of thing. I explained to him Ferdinand Grau's activities. He was at once suspicious and supposed it would be very expensive. I assured him if I went with him, he would get a special price. He tried to escape, but I would not let him go, explaining that if he really were so fond of his wife, it oughtn't to be too much. At last he consented. I called up Ferdinand and primed him for the encounter, then drove with the baker to his house to get the photographs of his wife. The dark person dashed out of the shop to meet us. She circled round the Ford.
Bread would have been nicer, Poopy, but you would have your own silly way.
That'll do, said Poopy, vexedly. We went up to the parlor, the dark person following. Her quick eyes were everywhere. The baker was losing his nerve. He did not intend to look for the photographs under those eyes. Now leave us, said he bluntly, at last.
She pouted. A pretty gallant you are,
Defiant, her breasts wagging beneath her tight-fitting jumper, she flounced out of the room. From a green plush album, the baker now produced a couple of pictures and showed them to me. His wife as bride, himself beside her, with tilted waxed mustaches. There she stood, laughing. Then another, in which, thin, worn out with work, with frightened eyes, she sat on the extreme edge of a chair. Two little pictures, one whole life. Ferdinand Grau received us in a frock coat. He looked grave and dignified. That was part of his trade. He recognized that for many mourners, respect for their grief was more important than the grief itself. On the walls of the studio in gilt frames hung several imposing portraits in oil, and beneath them the tiny photographs from which they had been done, so that a customer might see at a glance what could be made of even the most faded snapshot. Ferdinand showed the baker around, inquiring which style he preferred. The baker, in his turn, asked if the prices were not according to size. Ferdinand explained that it was not so much a matter of superficial measurement as of treatment, whereupon the baker at once expressed a preference for the biggest.
"You have very good taste," commented Ferdinand. "That is a portrait of the Princess Borghese. 800 marks, framed."
The baker's jaw dropped.
"An unframed?"
720.
The baker offered 400. Ferdinand shook his lion's head.
"For 400 marks, the most you could have would be a head in profile. Not a half length and full face. It's double the work, you see."
The baker thought that, after all, a profile head would do quite well. Ferdinand drew his attention to the fact that both photos were full face.
"Not Titian could paint a profile from them," said he.
The baker was sweating. He was annoyed he had not foreseen this when the photographs were taken. But he had to admit that Ferdinand was right. Full face was one half face more than profile. A higher price was clearly warranted. The baker could not bring himself to it. So far, Ferdinand had been quite restrained. Now he began to persuade. His powerful bass resounded through the big studio. "As an expert, I must admit it was a fine piece of work." The baker was soon ripe, especially when Ferdinand conjured up the disconcerting effect so grand a picture would have on ill-disposed neighbors.
"Very well," said he at last. "But 10% for cash, mind."
"Agreed," replied Ferdinand. 10% off, but an advance for expenses, colors, canvas, 300 marks.
They argued back and forth for some time, then at last came to terms and began to discuss details of treatment. The baker wanted a pearl necklace and a good brooch with diamonds painted in as extras. They did not appear in the photographs.
"Of course," explained Ferdinand, "your wife's jewelry shall certainly be painted. It would be better if you could bring it to me here for an hour, so that I can make it as lifelike as possible."
The baker flushed.
"I haven't got it now. It is, that is, well, her relatives have it."
"Ach so. Well, it doesn't really matter. Did the brooch look like the one in that picture there, for example?" suggested Ferdinand.
The baker nodded.
"Not quite so large."
"Good, then we'll make it like that. And we don't need the necklace at all. Pearls all look much alike."
The baker breathed again.
"And when will the picture be ready?"
"In 6 weeks."
"Good."
The baker took his leave. Ferdinand and I were alone in the studio.
"Do you really need 6 weeks for it?" I asked.
"Ach, what do you think?
4 or 5 days, perhaps. But I couldn't tell him that, or he would be calculating what I earn an hour and figure he was being done. With 6 weeks, he will be satisfied. The same with the Princess Borghese. It's human nature, my dear Bob. If I had told him it was a seamstress, he wouldn't have valued his picture half so much.
This is the sixth time that deceased wives have had jewelry like that in the picture there. Extraordinary coincidence, isn't it? It has been a wonderful draw, that picture of old Louisa Wolfe. I looked round. Pictures that had not been claimed by their owners, or had not been paid for, from immobile faces, eyes long since moldering in the grave, stared down from the wall. All human beings that had once breathed and hoped. "Doesn't this make you sad, Ferdinand?" He shrugged his shoulders. "Cynical, if you like. One is sad when one thinks about life. Cynical when one sees what people make of it." "Yes, but with some, at any rate, it goes deeper."
"True. But then they don't have pictures painted."
He stood up.
"After all, isn't it just as well, Bob, that they should have their bit of fun that is so important to them? It keeps them going, staves off the evil day when they will be alone. And to be alone, really alone, without illusion, that way lies madness and suicide." The big bare room was like a vault in the half-twilight. Next door, one could hear footsteps coming and going, the housekeeper. She did not show herself when any of us was there. She hated us, because she imagined we set Grau against her. I left, and the busy clamor of the street below was like a warm bath.